Yes, it was just like Vicksburg, Corey thought. But without Lucille and Charles and Mildred Thompson and Alan Carter and Fred. At least he hadn't lost his leg. He gave thanks for that. The wound was healing, and after being laid up for several days at first, he was now able to get around again fairly well. It was going to leave an ugly scar on his leg, but he could live with that. He had no doubt that Abner had saved his life. Someday, he would repay that debt, Corey vowed. July turned to August, and several more weeks dragged by. Corey and Abner spent most of their time in a rifle pit in the defensive line ringing the city. Corey had never experienced such trench warfare before. Long, boring hours of doing nothing but waiting and watching, then fierce bursts of firing whenever someone was foolish or careless enough to expose himself to sniper fire from the other side. Corey estimated that he had fired hundreds of rounds. He didn't know if a one of them had hit anything except the dirt or log breastworks behind which the Yankees crouched, 50 yards away. One morning, Corey came out of a doze to hear an unusual sound. Silence. He had grown so accustomed to the roar of the Federal artillery that not hearing it seemed wrong somehow. Abner slept beside him in the trench. Corey shook his shoulder.
Abner. Abner, wake up.
No. Abner sat up, shaking his head groggily.
What is it?
Listen,
Corey told him. Abner frowned.
Listen to what? I don't hear nothing.
That's right. The Yankees aren't firing on the city.
Abner's eyes widened in surprise.
Son of a gun, you're right.
He looked up at the clear blue sky.
No damn Yank shells flying over our heads. That's a mighty nice change.
Why do you think they've stopped?
I don't have no idea. I'm just glad they have, and I'll bet the folks in town are too.
Corey didn't doubt that. For the battered civilians, any respite from the bombardment was a welcome one. He wondered how long this one would last. On occasion over the past few weeks, the Yankees had paused in their shelling, but never for very long. As the morning passed and the shelling did not resume, it became obvious that there was something different about this lull. A lieutenant named Bean came along the trench and ordered Corey, Abner, and the other men manning this section to climb out and advance to the enemy trenches. Bean was the latest in a long line of junior officers commanding the company. Lieutenant Stockard and the half-dozen or so who had followed him had all been killed in battle over the summer.
"Lieutenant," Abner asked, "are we supposed to just waltz up to the Yankees line like we're just visiting? They're liable to shoot us up on the way over there."
"Have you seen any sign of the enemy this morning, Private?" Bean asked.
"The rumor is that Sherman has withdrawn. That's why the Federal guns have fallen silent."
"You mean given up, sir?" Corey said. "That doesn't sound like Sherman to me."
"Oh, I wasn't aware that you were personally acquainted with General Sherman, Private."
Corey flushed at the sarcasm. "I'll go," he said, using his rifle to brace himself as he started to climb up out of the trench.
"Me too, I reckon," Abner said.
He and the other men followed Corey's lead, clambering out of the trench and advancing into the no-man's land between the Confederate and Union lines. Corey held himself stiffly as he moved forward. He expected rifle fire to erupt at any second from the Yankee trenches. He tried to prepare for the shock of bullets striking his body, but no shots came from the enemy. Anticipation made Corey increase his pace, his gait a little awkward because he still limped slightly on his wounded leg. He trotted toward the Union lines, rifle held slanted across his chest. Abner let out a loud whistle of surprise when he and Corey reached the first of the Yankee trenches. It was empty. Nothing remained to show that the Yankees had ever been there, not even a discarded ammunition pouch or canteen. Corey turned and shouted back to Bean,
"They're gone, Lieutenant!"
Shading his eyes with a hand, Abner peered up and down the line of trenches.
"Nary a damn Yank to be seen," he said. "They're gone, sure enough."
Corey could barely believe it. After the battles along Peachtree Creek and then east of Atlanta, followed by the weeks of pounding from the Yankee guns, it was hard to accept the fact that Sherman had picked up and left without conquering the city. And he saw the evidence with his own eyes, heard the telltale silence of the big guns with his own ears. They had won. Despite everything, against all odds, they had stood firm and denied the Yankees their goal. Corey suddenly felt weak, almost like he was going to pass out. He leaned on his rifle to steady himself as Abner tipped back his head and let out a howl of triumph. Other men echoed the cry, and soon the cheering began to spread. Slowly, as the realization that the Yankees were gone spread from trench to trench, battlement to battlement, the cheers followed, all the way around Atlanta. Corey had never seen such a celebration as the one that took place over the next 4 days. War-weary denizens of the city, soldiers and civilians alike, could hardly believe their good fortune. Church bells rang merrily for hours on end, and crowds thronged the streets, stepping around shell craters to shake hands with their neighbors and slap each other on the back in congratulations. They had outlasted the Yankees. Perhaps all was not lost after all. Parties were planned, including one giant victory ball to which everyone still in Atlanta would be invited. Corey enjoyed the respite from the tension that had gripped him for weeks. Instead of catching catnaps whenever he could in the trenches, now he could sleep for long, uninterrupted stretches. Supplies were still scarce, and hunger gnawed at his belly most of the time, but at least he could rest. And he could feel the rest restoring some of the strength he had lost while recuperating from the wound in his leg. The only problem was that far in the back of his mind, a tiny voice warned him that all this was too good to be true. It was the evening of the fourth day after the Yankees' apparent withdrawal that bad news reached Atlanta from scouts ranging south and west of the city. Instead of pulling back to the north, Sherman had shifted at least some of his army to the west. He was still after the Macon and Western Railroad, which meant that he was still after Atlanta as well. A bitter taste filled Corey's mouth when Lieutenant Bean came hurrying through the camp, calling out orders for the men to get ready to move. Corey perched on a stump while Abner sat cross-legged on the ground nearby, smoking his pipe. He knocked the bowl against a rock and said, "Dagnabbit, I don't like the sound of that." "Neither do I," Corey said. Abner looked at him through eyes narrowed with suspicion.
"You don't reckon the Yankees will come back, do you?"
"I think there's an even better chance they were never really gone." Corey got to his feet and slung his ammunition pouch and canteen over his shoulder. "I told the lieutenant I didn't think Sherman would give up that easy." Abner grinned.
"Well, hell, 4 days without fighting is that much, I guess. Wish it could have been more, though."
So did Corey. It would have been all right with him if he had never had to take up arms and do battle again. There had been a certain excitement and glamour in riding with Nathan Bedford Forrest, to go along with the undeniable danger of cavalry operations. But the past year spent experiencing combat as an infantryman had taught Corey the truth of war. It was a hard, bloody business with absolutely nothing to recommend it, except for the fact that sometimes a man had to fight for what he believed in, fight to protect himself, his family, his home. Sometimes there was no other way. Hardee's corps moved out that night, along with the corps commanded by General Stephen Lee. They marched south from Atlanta, following the railroad. At tiny East Point Station, not far south of the city, the tracks split. The Atlanta and West Point, which reportedly was under attack already by the Federals, veered off to the southwest. The main line, the Macon and Western, headed southeast toward Macon and continued toward the sea, ultimately arriving at the coastal city of Savannah. Along the way, it passed near the Confederate prison camp known as Andersonville, where as many as 30,000 Yankee prisoners were being held. Corey had heard rumors that Sherman had sent some cavalry to free the prisoners at Andersonville, but the attempt had failed. That was good news. The last thing the Confederates in Georgia needed right now was 30,000 more Yankees suddenly turned loose in their rear. The marching troops followed the Macon and Western tracks to Jonesboro, about 20 miles south of Atlanta. They had tramped all night, and as dawn began to turn the sky gray, They moved wearily into position just west of the settlement.